When Donald Trump declared he would fix the U.S. Postal Service, he was using the word fix the same way veterinarians do when you bring in your dog. Trump wasted an inordinate amount of his presidential power and prestige in a failed attempt to neuter an agency that literally delivers for the people. Extraordinary postal workers move our letters and packages by truck, car, airplane, boat, motorbike, mule, and of course by foot, to any address across town or across the country. Both essential and effective, it's the most popular federal agency, with 91% of the public approving its work. Thus, an uproar of protests killed Trump's attempt to gut it. When it comes to bad public policy, however, failure is just a way of saying, let's try the back door. Trump was defeated, but he left behind an undistinguished postmaster general named Louis DeJoy, who had only two qualifications for the job. He was a Trump mega donor, and he was a peer of corporate powers that have long wanted to privatize the Postal Service. In March, before the new Biden presidency had taken charge of the postal system, DeJoy popped through the back door with his own 10-year plan to fix the agency. Rhetorically, his plan promised to, quote, achieve service excellence by making mail delivery more consistent and reliable. How? By consistently cutting service and reliably gouging customers. Specifically, DeJoy proposed to close numerous mail processing facilities, eliminate jobs, reduce post office hours of service, and cut the standard of delivering our first-class mail from 3 days to five. Oh, also, raise stamp prices. This is Jim Hightower saying, delivering lousy service at higher prices is intended to destroy public support, opening up the service to take over by private profiteers. And who gets joy from that? The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some fun today. Joe Manchin put out a statement. Talked about fiscal sanity. Concern that we're not going to be able to pay Social Security and Medicare, and that's why we can't do anything else, evidently. He's now concerned about the spending. Still pushing his strategic pause, which I said from the beginning, and for those who said I was crazy months ago, I fear we get nothing. I'm sticking with that. I said it back months ago, and here we are. And I don't even think Manchin's the worst part of it. But here to share some thoughts on, well, will we get something on the infrastructure front? Will we get anything? Will one, the other, both, nothing? That's why I've asked our good friend Mateus Vernango to come talk with us. Mateus is an economics professor at Bucknell University, one of the smartest guys I know on the economics front. Mateus, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, no, thank you for having me, Rick.
So, are we getting anything? Is this going to happen? Or is this going to go down in flames?
Well, I wish, it's one of those things, I'm smart enough to tell you I'm not sure. And I wish, I could say it's a simple one that I wish we get something, meaning I wish they compromise and at least we get the smaller package, the bipartisan $1 trillion, spending bill going through. But the thing is, as you said, it was sort of built up in a way that I think honestly, Biden and the administration did have a good strategy. The first time that there was a strategy in place in order to bind these, sort of smaller, acceptable for both sane Republicans and conservative Democrats bill that they could jointly pass, but also tying almost everything else that is part of the Democratic agenda, including Biden. So that, expansion of Medicare, expansion of, rights, things like, non-healthcare, childcare, many provisions then, not just infrastructure, social benefits that are necessary
right.
for a society that has been on a down spiral for workers for a very long while. And so, and the Democrats have been fighting for a very long while. And they had this strategy, which made it very reasonable. So we tie these two things together. So we pass this one that it's bipartisan, and that has to go with this other one that it's for everybody. Whether we're going to see that or not, and I think, again, you know, Biden didn't go to Chicago today. He stayed. He had meetings with both Sinema and Manchin. So clearly the administration is trying to get this. And they have asked a number. And I don't think they got a number from Manchin or Sinema, what would be the number that they would accept. And that's the part that frightens me about all of this. If I had a number, I would say, okay, they're trying to bargain it down. But it seems they're trying to kill it.
Yeah. No, Manchin did say on the one Sunday show that, you know, $1 trillion, $1.5 trillion, maybe he came up because the one woman did try and hammer him down on a number. And I'm of the mindset, look, at this point, I'll take the $1.5 trillion just to get us moving and to get things into place.
If he signed and we voted the $1.5 trillion, sure, I would agree with you. But if it's an open sort of end, I'm not sure what I would, you know, if I was one of person in the Progressive Caucus and you ask me what to do, I'll tell you the truth. I wouldn't know what to tell you because it seems like what they want is to just stay with the small one. And I should say, and there is a lot of money that, you know, both Manchin and Sinema have received the biggest numbers of the, of funds from donors associated to all the sort of wrong corporate interests. So,
well, there was a story the other day.
That's not helpful.
Yeah, there was the story the other day where, you know, Sinema got, what, $750,000 $750,000 from Big Pharma and then voted and, you know, basically killed the drug bill that would help lower prices. And this is where you come back to the world that we're in.
All of this is maddening. All of this is maddening. And again, it's maddening not just because of the politics of it. I should say the other thing that it's I don't even want to go on how much Republicans have been playing politics with this because we're tying in all of this, the debt ceiling and the shutdown of the government. And they're playing absolutely politics with that. But I should say all of this is unnecessary because there is no danger that we're overspending, that we are, you know, that the government has no ability to pay, that inflation is around the corner. All of those fears are absolutely not, you know, not reasonable. And so we are in a situation in which 5 million jobs still have been lost and have not been recovered. The economy is still in a iffy recovery because we are in the middle of a pandemic that, you know, sure, Delta is, thank God, coming down, but, you know, it's still not gone. There are still supply constraints here and there. There are still a lot of people hurting. And so the notion that we are on the verge of an economy that's close to full employment, that inflation is around the corner, there is inflation, but the kind of inflation that we have had is because of the supply constraints, not because we have, you know, healthy economy close to full employment, and also the kind of inflation that I want to see, the inflation that is driven by wages and by people getting, you know, so that wages are winning price, you know, against prices, and that people are getting because they have more bargaining power, they have the ability to, you know, not corporations getting more money because they can charge you, you know, and so on and so forth, but because, you know, people can get higher wages and corporations are forced to reduce their margins. And that's not happening. You know, it hasn't happened, you know, in our generation. I mean, you have to go back to the 70s when I was a kid to have something like that in the United States. And so the notion that we, you know, and we talked about this last time I was here or the previous time, you know, this is not that 70s show. We're not in that position yet. And so those fears, it's not just the politics of it that it's maddening. It's the economics of it, the technical stuff. It's not there. So this other part is not a question of what I, you know, my personal preferences. Sure, I prefer, you know, a broader sort of more inclusive welfare state. But forget that for a second. There's no reason that, you know, if you wanted to spend, let's say that you are a Republican, very concerned with the American position externally, and you think we should spend way more in the military. We have space, actually, to do all of those things. There is no reason why the American government cannot spend. I wouldn't say let's go and spend a lot more in the military and staying in Afghanistan. But, you know, so I think that's a mistake. But you know, it's not like we don't have the resources. So right. If we have the resources to rebuild schools in Afghanistan, as we did over the last two decades, we should have the money to, you know, improve the living, you know, conditions of people in the United States.
No, that just makes a little bit of common sense. But here we are in this moment, and as you pointed out, there's some economic problems. There's some things going on. Still in the middle of the pandemic, we've got supply chain shortages. We've got all this stuff going on, and now the Republicans choose to manufacture a crisis by holding us hostage for what I'm still not quite sure what they want, other than scorched earth or chaos. Are you getting anything out of what they actually want for this?
No, that's it. I will say something. I was munching today about this, and I've been thinking about this. And, you know, if they go crazy, I think we should go crazy too. So, because what they're saying is, we're not going to pay the debt. Okay, so you're not going to pay the debt that it's already accrued. So, and there's no reason not to pay it because it's debt in domestic. I always say this, coming from Argentina, having been raised in Brazil, we sometimes take debt in foreign currency, in dollars. And that one, the Brazilian government, the Argentinian government cannot pay in their own currency. So, you know, they have limitations. This is purely debt in domestic currency. The U.S. has no limitation. It doesn't mean that the U.S. can do whatever they want. No, sure, there are limits. But, you know, there's no significant danger, and there shouldn't be any danger of the United States defaulting on its debt. And the reason that they're putting this is exactly to score, you know, political points. So if they're going to, you know, put the American economy on the, you know, brink of collapse because of this, I think because there's nothing that forbids the government to continue spending and fund the debt. And the question then, it's a constitutional question. Is this debt ceiling, for example, constitutional? And I'm not, you know, you should invite a lawyer to discuss that stuff. But I've heard many things that suggest that this is unconstitutional, you know, and unconstitutional. And so they should test that limit. What happens?
Yeah, I just think it's stupid. I the time to argue over spending is before you spend the money, not after you've spent it. I mean, this is just weird to me. And again, I come back to, I understood the past when, you know, Mitch McConnell and the Republicans during the Obama years wanted Obama to fail. They had things they wanted, like sequester. They had to get the sequester. They had to cut because they were obsessed with you know, squeezing the quarter till the eagle screamed. And then we came in with Trump, and it was spent like drunken sailors, and you didn't hear a peep out of them.
Well, but this has been going on for a while. I always tell my students here at Bucknell. So, you know, if you look at historically, since Gerald Ford, you know, we have to go back all the way to Ford. The Republicans have been the party of big government. They spend more when they come in. I mean, Ford increased spending and the deficits went up. Same for Reagan, same for Trump, for Bush Senior, same for Bush Junior, same for Trump. They deficits go up because they cut taxes for the wealthy. They spend more in the military. And so deficits and spending go up. And in reverse, Democrats have become the party of small government, trying to preserve but not expand. The only expansion that has been since Nixon and you know, an environmental agency, you know, it's been Obamacare. And of the welfare state, I mean, the young expansion of you know, welfare programs, and all three of them, Carter, you know, Clinton and Obama, with differences. I'm not saying that are all equal, and you know, but they all had you know, lower spending at the beginning. I mean, after you take, you know, Obama's you know, 2009 package, it's diminishing spending and lower deficits. So the party of fiscal responsibility, and I'm not a huge fan of the term, has been the Democratic Party. And Republicans have been the party of big spending, big government, but it's big government for the very wealthy and the corporations. And that's an important part of this story. So what they're doing is the bidding of corporations, of corporate America and wealthy individuals. So they're guaranteeing that we're not going to tax them. And I think that one of the important things here in this discussion is that Biden has bought, because I think it's the moment of this, Biden has bought into the idea that we have to tax the wealthy, that the wealthy have run amok, that they don't pay their fair share.
Yeah, about time.
That, it's high time that they pay their fair share. And I think that that's the danger in this. That's the debate we're having, and it's a debate important. So it is political. It is as much as it was for Obama, because the 2024 election is already being fought here. I think if we don't pass this stuff, it's going to be very difficult to win. You know, whoever goes, if he goes for re-election or you know, Kamala or whoever it is, but you know, it's going to be much harder.
No, 2022 is going to be a bloodbath if you don't get something done. Not that 2022 is going to be easy, even if you do. But you know, I've talked to people who've already said
2022 is going to be an uphill. I meant 2024 presidential. I mean, you know, because let's be serious. The American system is such that the likelihood of passing stuff it's this year and some part of next year. But then we're gone because then we're already in campaign mode. And it will be 2 years of campaign mode.
Yep.
So Obama had basically 2 years of government. The rest was, you know, he got reelected and then they blocked everything else he did in the second term. So he had 2 years out of eight and then he resisted. And, you know, I wish we had those 8 years. I mean, I'd rather have those 8 years than any, you know, the 4 years with Trump. Good Lord. I always say destroying is much easier than constructing stuff. And that's the danger. We have a party that comes into power to destroy stuff,
yep.
And they're very good at destroying stuff. And then we have a party that we're bickering about how to construct stuff. And constructing is admittedly harder than destroying. But, you know, we should get our act together and start constructing stuff.
No, I'm right there with you. My grandfather used to say any idiot can tear down a house. It takes someone with a little skill to build it. And we're seeing this playing out right in front of us. So in looking at what we're going to come up against in the next couple of days, you've got the debt ceiling coming, the possible government shutdown. You got the infrastructure vote that may or may not happen, I guess, tomorrow. They're talking about it. It's probably not going to. Probably going to push that off a little bit. It seems like McConnell's plan of stall, delay, and draw out to try and run out the clock to get to where you said next year, nothing ain't going to get done. That seems to be the plan to me.
Yes, no, I would agree. And again, I think that the play here is for Democrats. And I think Biden is on. I think, you know, I would say this surprisingly to me, but I think Biden is not just for show, you know, appearing to be on the side of the progressives on this. I think he has bought into the Democratic program, you know. He's closer to the progressives on this debate, so he's trying to get Sinema and Manchin to agree to something. So, I am, you know, less hopeful I was last time. Let's put it that way. That we are gonna get. I mean, I don't think we're gonna get the 3.5, but you know, I'm hopeful that we are gonna. I mean, I'm hopeful that we. I hope we do get the bipartisan one, and obviously then we don't shut down and we don't do anything crazy like the faulting on that, which is unnecessary. But I do hope we do get some sort of expanded social spending, because that's not just necessary for the Democratic Party to win the election in 2024.
No, it's necessary for the country. I mean, ultimately, we need the investment.
It's necessary for the people. It's necessary for everybody. It's necessary for our souls. I mean, it's necessary to be able to look in, you know, in the mirror and say that we're not all losing it. You know, I think that we're at that point. I mean, the last 4 years were pretty, you know, harsh. Post-Trump, on top of that, a pandemic, things have been very difficult. So I think that the country needs that, you know. And if we don't do it, you know, I think we're on the verge of a social crisis that, you know, we haven't seen in a very long while.
So you have some fear that we could be heading for, you know, if all this goes the wrong way, we could be heading for really, really troubled waters.
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's be serious. We had a riot with people entering the, you know,
Point taken.
Yes,
there it is. I mean, I don't see that going away anytime soon either.
Yes.
But Mateus, I appreciate you taking some time, sharing your expertise. As always, frightful stuff. I'm hoping we get some stuff done.
Me too. Thank you for having me.
Good stuff. Our good friend, Mateus Vernango, professor of economics there at Bucknell. Love to hear your thoughts. Are you concerned? Is inflation taking a bite? Have you seen your wages go up? I'd love to hear it. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1929. That was the day a mistrial was declared in the case of 16 textile mill unionists in North Carolina. The mistrial sparked 5 days of anti-union vigilante violence. Textile mill workers at Gastonia's Lorry Mill had been on strike since April 1st. They demanded higher wages and shorter work hours, union recognition, and an end to the hated stretch-out system. Soon, textile workers at Bessemer City's American Mill walked off the job in solidarity and joined the National Textile Workers Union. Ella Mae Wiggins was one of the strike leaders at American Mill. She was known for her militancy, but also for organizing black workers into the union. As the strike wore on, mill owners evicted dozens of families from company housing. Wiggins helped set up a tent city. On June 7th, sheriff's deputies attacked strikers who marched to Lorry Mill to call out remaining workers. The police arrived at the tent colony later that evening to disarm them, and Gastonia's police chief wound up dead. Immediately, more than 70 textile union members and leaders were rounded up and arrested. 16 stood trial for the murder of Chief Adderholt. The Anti-Union Committee of 100 smashed up the NTWU headquarters in Gastonia and Bessemer City. They kidnapped, beat, and threatened to kill several union members. The rampage continued as SCAB forces moved on to Charlotte to raid the offices of the International Labor Defense, who had handled the strikers' case. 5 days into the terror, Wiggins was killed on her way to a union solidarity rally. Outrage over her murder forced mill owners to improve conditions and wages, but the fight to organize would continue for years.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Interesting new study put out by the folks at the Illinois Economic Policy Institute found that people who went through apprenticeship programs, the building trades apprenticeship program, something I've been telling my kids about. Look, go be learn to be an electrician, learn to be a plumber, go through the union apprenticeship programs. You get to earn money while you're learning. You don't have to take on a lifetime of student loan debt, and you make really, really good money doing it. They came out with a number that it kind of stopped me in my tracks. They said that, on an inflated, adjusted for inflation income basis, what they found is the fiscal outcomes for construction workers in union work settings and in non-union work settings versus all other workers by level of education. And what they came out with was, someone who had, less than a high school education was probably going to make somewhere around $23,000 a year. And, the lower chance of having health insurance, virtually no chance of having a retirement, any of that stuff. When they looked at, high school education, they said like $38,000 a year you'd make, some college, but you didn't get a degree, just under 40, an associate's degree, they pump you up to $48,000. And then, up from there, bachelor's degree, 68, an advanced degree, 96. What they found is in the union construction field, people were making over $58,000 a year with just a high school education. So you're looking at, an additional, like a $20,000 premium for being a union member and getting through some of these programs. In the non-union sector, what they found is there was almost no difference between a high school graduate and a non-union construction worker. It was that union advantage. It was that ability to collectively bargain. And the bigger part of that grabbed my attention was the fact that in the construction industry, unionized workers had like almost 90% of them had private health insurance. Almost 70% of them had private pension plans. Whereas in the non-union sector, what you saw is just over half had health insurance and not even a quarter had pension plans. And you go, why is this important? Well, what's coming? And I hope we get this infrastructure bill. I do. I know I've been negative about getting things through because, look, I know how Democrats operate sometimes. I would love nothing more than to see the bipartisan bill pass along with the human infrastructure path, the Build Back Better plan, because there's so much in that we need. And even if it's not funded like I would like it to see funded, we got to get it into place so that we start moving and we get moving in that direction. But here's the thing. If we get any infrastructure bill, we need people who are going to be able to you know, to pour concrete, to wire things, to drive heavy machinery. We need people with skills. And nobody does this better than the building trades and their apprenticeship programs. And I saw this study and I'm like, this is what we should be pushing people into. These are solid, good, family-sustaining wage jobs with retirement security and all of that stuff. And yet, I don't think we hear enough of this, at least not in the circles that I hear people talk about. The idea that we get people the job training that they need and the ability to have a collective bargaining agreement that's going to increase their wages. Now, look, I know some electricians who are making six figures. They're good electricians. I know welders who are doing incredibly well because we need them. If we're going to rebuild our roads and bridges, we kind of need people who are going to be able to do it. And this seems to be one of those things that I think we've left behind. And I'll tell you, I've always said you respect the job. I don't care what you do for a living. I don't care what it is. There should be respect. There should be dignity in that job. There should be reward for work. And that's not been the way it's been for a long time. Now, I love what Mateus said a minute ago. He goes, look, you know, we're getting a little bit of inflation, but the good kind. Because we've been trained like Pavlovian dogs to every time we hear the word inflation to start foaming. And, you know, as he was talking about, you know, this ain't the 70s, he's right. Because I remember my grandparents. They bought their house in the late 60s. Mid to late 60s. And by the middle 70s, their mortgage was a joke because my grandfather was making that in a day. Because we had that inflationary period during the 70s. And understand, inflation is good for debtors because you're going to get more wages. You're going to be able to pay off your debt. Not so good for people who have a lot of money. And, that's why we have this obsession. This is why every time you turn around, we have to talk about it. We have to crush inflation. Look, I hate paying more for things just like anybody else, but wages have to keep up. And that's the difference. If we have inflation where just prices go up and you can't afford anything, that's a problem. But I'm looking around and some of the wage structures are moving upward. That is a good thing. Now is the time to put this into law. Now is the time to go, look, everybody's paying $15 an hour. Everybody. It's time to pass a $15 an hour minimum wage. We can do it now because people are paying it now. Because here's the concern. Year or two down the road, they go, well, you know, I'm going to start clawing some of that back. And prices are going to stay sticky. They're going to stay where they are. Wages are going to fall. We're going to have problems. This is why I keep saying the number one thing we should be doing right now is organizing people into unions. Get those wages, those benefits, all of the nice things that they're throwing out just to get people in the door. Get it in writing. Put it in a contract. Make it enforceable. Hold them to it. Just my thought. Love to hear yours, though. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Are you afraid of the inflation? Do you think things are getting out of hand? I know I had a conversation today with a friend who was like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. Gas is 3.25. I go, yeah, it's been around $3 for a while. But his wages went up $5 an hour. Going to be interesting to see how it plays out. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
The storm's 150-mile-an-hour winds wreaked havoc on offshore oil production platforms, as well as onshore oil and gas processing plants.
Hurricane Ida's destruction caused a record number of oil spills in the Gulf of Mexico. Today's children face more climate disasters than their grandparents, new study warns. Plus,
11 felony charges and 20 misdemeanors. Charges include 4 homicides.
California utility PG&E charged in wildfire that killed 4.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
A new report says that animals are shape-shifting in response to the climate crisis. Same here. These aren't love handles, okay? Before the sea levels rise, I'm growing my own water wings.
I know the feeling. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, well, the Republicans in the Senate are trying to destroy the country and the global economy, basically, but they're also screwing over a bunch of natural disaster victims right now.
Yes, they are. On Monday, Senate Republicans blocked legislation to suspend the debt ceiling, which pays for spending already incurred, and to keep the government in operation, which also blocked emergency disaster aid for victims of Hurricane Ida.
Well done, Republicans.
Speaking of Hurricane Ida, NOAA reports that the deadly storm, which made a direct hit on Louisiana and caused billions of dollars in damages, also caused an unprecedented number of oil spills in the Gulf of Mexico. 55, a new record. The new analysis underscores the fragility of the oil industry's aging infrastructure on the Gulf Coast as hurricanes become more intense and extreme due to man-made global warming caused by the oil industry.
Ironic, ain't it?
Back to Congress, an intense time for President Joe Biden's climate agenda as Democratic congressional leaders work to feverishly forge a path forward with a handful of so-called moderate Democrats on Biden's Build Back Better Act reconciliation package as Republicans throw wrenches into the machinery. DeSmog Blog reports that the oil industry has launched an all-out pressure campaign to kill off a proposal by congressional Democrats to tax the industry for the first time for its methane leaks, an extremely powerful greenhouse gas, in order to fund climate programs.
And they don't like that for some reason?
They don't. And it matters, because a new study projects that even if countries fulfill their current pledges to cut greenhouse gas emissions, children born in 2020 will, on average, endure 7 times more extreme heat waves and more than twice as many droughts over their lifetimes as their grandparents.
Wow.
Today's children will also see almost 3 times as many river floods and crop failures, and twice the number of wildfires as people born 60 years ago.
Sorry, kids. We tried.
And that is on average. Increases in exposure will be much higher in some countries. It's the first research to assess how climate extremes will affect different age groups and highlights the intergenerational injustice posed by the climate crisis.
Grim.
In other news, in Northern California, prosecutors have charged electric utility giant Pacific Gas and Electric with 4 counts of homicide and multiple other felonies for its role in causing the 2020 Zog fire near Redding, which killed 4 people and destroyed hundreds of homes.
Of course, no one will go to jail, even if they are found guilty. They have been charged before with manslaughter, and I cannot believe the state has not taken over PG&E at this point and put them out of our misery.
State fire investigators found the Zog fire was sparked by a dying tree that PG&E knew was dangerously close to its transmission lines. Here's Shasta County District Attorney Stephanie Bridget.
If you've got a known hazard that sits for 2 years, it's just not an accident. They knew it was there. They left it. They didn't remove it. And people died.
Last year, the company pleaded guilty to 84 counts of manslaughter over a 2018 blaze that destroyed the town of Paradise.
Why not? No one's going to jail.
But some good news.
Good.
In Germany, a good sign for climate policy after the country's center-left party, the Social Democrats, narrowly defeating retiring Chancellor Angela Merkel's conservative party in federal elections, with the environmentalist Green Party coming in a very strong third. Here in the U.S., the Biden EPA has issued major rules to cut HFCs, greenhouse gases used in refrigeration that are hundreds of thousands of times more powerful than CO2. The new standards are widely backed by industry and will ultimately cut HFCs by 85% over the next 15 years. Finally, Norway has set a national target of 2025 to ban sales of new gasoline and diesel vehicles.
Wow.
But it turns out on its current trajectory, the country is on track to reach 100% electric vehicle sales as early as April.
Wow.
Yes.
Well done, Norway. It can be done. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So evidently, the guy who showed up to the January 6th insurrection wearing his Team USA jacket has pled guilty. He's agreed he's going to help. He's going to do what he's going to do what he can do to help keep himself out of jail. He's the guy who ran around saying, you know, F Nancy Pelosi and F Chuck Schumer and all of that. I'm curious what he's going to end up with. He could have gotten what was a maximum sentence of 20 years. Those sentencing guidelines, they say, call for somewhere between 21 and 27 months. So it'll be interesting to see if the Olympic swimmer will be spending a boatload of time as a guest of the state. But you never wear a license plate to a crime. When you're criming, don't wear a license plate. I think this is the central message of this. When you're criming, do not wear a license plate. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, I've asked our good friend Bob Ney to come talk with us. Bob's a former Ohio congressman and political analyst. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Right. And if you wear a license plate, you end up making license plates, right?
I
know.
I wasn't going to go there.
I'll go there. My picture was high profile. I think this is a disturbing story, by the way. I can't understand. I don't know whether to blame the prosecutors or the courts. I'm not sure. The first one pleads guilty, gets a little tap on the hand, right?
Yep.
First, I can't remember who it was. And then they're going to, quote, send a message. Well, the government tried to send a message with a longer sentence, but, you know, the judge didn't feel that way. Now, here you've got the gold medalist. He pleads guilty to the felony charge, of course, of obstructing an election. And in a, as they say, a surprise move, he plans to cooperate with the Justice Department. What is so shocking about that? Now that he's caught, you know, he plans to cooperate with them. So what happens? Oh, yeah, I saw him here at the rally. I saw her at the rally. It's all on film. They don't need him to cooperate. They need to say, hey, thanks for your offer, and you know, we're going to ask for 4 years for you. That's what they need to do. In fact, a high-profile guy like him, set the bar. Give the example. That's just my feeling.
No, I'm right there with you.
I'm thinking that this is all starting to be blown by, you know, the prosecutors, who I guess have to react to a court that seems, I don't know, sympathetic to those who, you know, I've seen people sell pot and do a longer sentence.
There was the guy, you know, in Philadelphia, got caught stealing 3 peppermint patties.
There you
spent
go.
500 days waiting for trial. And then I don't, he got some just obscene.
Well, he had bad taste peppermint patties.
Yeah,
so they had to go after him for longer. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Not
it really is. You know, now this guy, he's going, the gold medalist is going to cooperate. What are they needing for? They ought to just, you know, say, fine, we're going to double your sentence. I don't know.
Yeah, no,
it's starting to become very irritating.
Because, no, we're in this position now where people are now saying, we can't go after the gold medalist. He was just a tourist that day. He did nothing wrong. He was just, you know, walking in the park. It was a patriotic day. It wasn't an insurrection, Bob.
Yeah. I know, selfies on their
own. It's crazy, crazy. Speaking of crazy, what is going on with your buddy Corey Lewandowski?
I just have read the stories. I don't have any personal inside information, but I will tell you, I mean, when this story broke today, and Corey had worked for me in 1990, let's see, it was 1998. He worked through two election cycles and then went on to work for, do you remember Bob Smith, who ran, I think he ran for, he was a senator.
I do.
And over, yeah, I don't know what he ran for, but Corey went over to work for him, then ended up working for a couple of, I don't know, lobby groups or something, and then he ended up with Donald Trump coming down the escalator. So, and then, of course, he was fired by Donald Trump, and then Trump hired Paul Manafort, which made it worse for him. But anyway, I read this story today, and the thing that stuck out at me, and again, I don't know what he did or didn't do, and he doesn't call me, but the thing that jumped out at me is that this is a, it seems like a pretty legitimate couple that are Trump supporters, big time Trump supporters. And they have four witnesses to back it up. And the donor is Trishelle Odom. And she went public with this about, you know, what he, what she says he did. And then, of course, this is the follow-up that tells you something here, because they have now removed him as chairman of the Make America Great Action Political Committee. Now, here's the thing, though. I noticed in the article, Rick, and it was Trump's director of communications, Taylor Budowich, who announced on on Twitter, not long, maybe a couple hours ago, I think, that former Attorney General Pam Bondi will be replacing Lewandowski as head of the Mega Action PAC. Because this is the PAC. This is the big money deal.
Yeah.
So he's being accused by one of the, you know, I don't know if they're going to take it to a court action or something or police, but he's being accused by one of the big donors, and he's running the donor PAC. So therefore, it's not a good deal. You,
you
know,
don't
obviously
screw with the money.
Right, right. And so, but here's what they said. That Corey Lewandowski will be going on to other endeavors, and we want to thank him. He will no longer be associated with Trump World. Trump World. That means all of it. You see, last time when he was fired because of Trump's daughter, and he was fired, but he still, you know, would go in the White House right on Air Force One. You know, it was kind of the wink and nod fire.
Right.
This is kind of the I'm going to fire you and close my eyes fire.
Yeah, because only one person gets to grab her by the you-know-what, and that's the Donald.
That's true. Yeah, and get away with it. So I think that, you know, this will lead to obviously other problems.
Yeah. Well, also, there's some rumor, and I don't know if it's true or not. I just happened to read it when I looked him up, and that evidently he's been possibly shacking up with the governor of South Dakota.
Oh, I didn't know that. When you're ahead of the spicy stuff, and he used to work for me years ago, so I didn't know that.
Yeah, because when I saw one, I googled it up, because I'm talking to Bob. I gotta bring this up to Bob. Maybe Bob knows if he's a philanderer. Who knows what. And I figured, well, crazy.
That is, well, when I read the story and it came out that it was a Trump donor today and it came public, I thought, okay, this isn't good. And then, of course, now that they've said he's not part of Trump World, that's pretty comprehensive. That's all of it.
Yeah. But, you know, on the Christy Noem thing, the conservative website American Greatness reported today that multiple anonymous sources had informed writer Pedro Gonzalez that Noem is having a month-long relationship with Lewandowski.
How does he have time to do the Megas?
I don't know, man. Maybe give him credit for, you know, finding more hours in the day than the rest of us have.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I see that. So, she's calling it a lie. I didn't. That's the first I've seen that story. Yeah. Now I'm going to have to read through it.
Now, the weird thing is, why would you hit on the donor's wife? I mean, that's the guy who could crush you. It is what it is.
It's the guy that did crushing.
Yeah.
I mean, this is saying that, you know, if they would have said, oh, we're shifting his duties to this, but they said, good luck, he's not in Trump World, then, you know, that ends it.
Yeah, well, let's get to the fun stuff today. Evidently, the three generals got grilled in the House, and you know, I watched most of it, and I got to be honest, I'm tired of the, you know, you get your 5 minutes to get your tweet in, or you get your your viral moment or whatever's going to get you invited on the cable news tonight. But you know, there was no real thought that went into. At least I didn't see it. Well, you know, what went wrong? How do we solve this problem? It just seemed like it was all a bunch of grandstanding, and I got to tell you, I'm tired of it.
Well, just for the listeners to know, you know, I many times, like other members, have been part of the private, you know, briefing, which is what happened with these generals and the committee. And then there's the public, right? And you can always bet Abu Ghraib stands out in my mind the best, Rick. We went in, we had this briefing on Abu Ghraib, we were shown this, you know, really disgusting video, and people were like, oh, you know, and then we went out for the hearing, and it turned different directions. It became more theatric, it became more speech-giving in your 5 minutes, everybody gets 5 minutes, you know, it became more dog and pony speech show. And I think with the generals, you know, there's, you know, a couple of points here where the generals, you know, said an option they had was, you know, to keep 2,500 of the troops there, et cetera. And again, options. So I'm sure that the generals laid out several paths, you know, that could be taken. I think the press secretary of the president said it correctly, that, you know, the president appreciates the advice he gets and then finally doesn't necessarily always agree with people. He wants candor, but he'll make his own decision. Now, there's no question also that it was a fairly rocky exit from Afghanistan. But I think they probably make a good point, and it can be applied to Donald Trump and Joe Biden,
yeah.
Rick, which is...
No, that was my point.
Yeah, which is this. Also, there's a second one, too. You know, setting these time frames, you know, Donald Trump, May 15th, and President Biden, August 31st, setting these time frames. And military people don't like him, so they spoke up on that. But beyond that, this was a 20-year hearing. This is where, you know, a lot of questions over the last four White Houses, the last four presidents to serve under those Congresses, there was a lot of 20 years here. And so, you know, I agree with you. I just didn't see it as the, okay, this is it, wow, defining moment.
Yeah.
It's a mess for 20 years. It is a mess.
And look, I'm not giving Biden a pass. There were some mistakes. But given the reality of the moment, I don't think it was as bad as it could have been. And I didn't hear that from anyone. I think it was a Herculean leap to get as many people out as they did, as quickly as they did. And personally, you know, look, I'm not a military person. I'm not the decider guy. But given the option of we're going to leave 2,500 people there, even though we said we're getting out, puts those 2,500 people at risk, in grave risk. And then if the government does collapse, I think it was McKenzie who said, well, that 2,500 number would then have to go to 5,000, which then takes me to what Biden was saying. His two options were simple: get out or escalate. That's how he saw it. There was no middle ground.
Well, that is the reality. To suggest that, first of all, to suggest that 2,500 American troops would have stopped the government from falling is ludicrous. Obviously, the generals still haven't read the intel reports correctly. You know, the intel is bad. It was bad. No one knew in 12 days the country would fall. So that wasn't an option to leave 2,500 people. You know, two presidents set deadline times. Again, Trump and Biden. Looking back on history here, it would probably have been better if we didn't set deadline times. Trump started it. Biden bought into it.
Yeah.
Okay, so they're both the same. You know, I'm not giving a pass to one or the other, but it would have been better had we just started to begin a process of doing what we wanted to do, which was to slowly, you know, clear out of the country. But we didn't do that. So, you know, fate dealt a deck of cards that you deal with. And, you know, most of the people got out. I know it wasn't 100%, and they're still working on things. But they, you know, and also they were dealing with a State Department that was not approving people way back in January. They wouldn't approve people, you know, the embassies to be vetted and to be screened through in the proper way. So there was a series of that. But I think that missing pieces because of speeches was to really dig into 20 years if they wanted to dig in, to find out what mistakes we made. Of course, I'll call that a little useless, Rick, because we sure didn't care about the mistake going into Iraq to rectify that mistake, did we?
Nope.
You know, to find out why our intel lied to us or did whatever they did. So, I think the hearings come and it went. You know,
but they got their moment. There were a couple of people like Matt Gaetz and the rest of them who, General Milley, you've got to resign. I guess over this Chinese phone call. And look, when this came out, when the Woodward and Costa book came out, my first thought was, I guarantee Milley didn't do anything out of his chain of command because he's a military guy. They follow orders. That's what they do. And what we found out is, at least what I'm hearing, is that all along he's telling people that this is going on, that he didn't do what was originally reported and run rogue over telling the Chinese that we'll tell you if I'm going to bomb you or not.
Right. And what Milley is publicly saying is that Trump officials knew the Chinese calls. And, he names them. So they knew about the calls. They might have actually been part of saying, yes, it's okay, go call to keep things calmed down. So, yes, he came out and said that they knew about the calls.
Now, the only thing that I would go after him over is, why is he talking to Woodward and Costa?
Well, I know. They all do. Just right, exactly. Why would you gain? Sometimes people think that, well, quote, their side of the story will get out there. It doesn't. You know, it
crazy.
Gets out there in the way that the writers want them to hear about it.
Yeah, nothing ever goes right that way.
Nothing. Nothing.
Lastly, I wanted to get your thoughts on, is there going to be a vote tomorrow on the infrastructure?
I think so. I think that I know that there's some grumblings. If it's not tomorrow, it will be this week. It can't go beyond this week. So the reason I'm not saying for certain it'll be tomorrow is because you never know if a couple of wrinkles come up. But the speaker's holding pretty adamant. I know she's getting, some political threats from some of the progressives. We're going to bring the bill down. But I think there are some Republican votes through Fred Upton of Michigan. And plus a couple of the centrists have said, well, we're going to vote for the $3.5 trillion, which I again argue somebody needs to sit Senator Manchin down and find out what number he likes, so they can kind of solve that. But, there's going to be an infrastructure bill passed. The speaker is smart enough to know she needs to get that moving. And that doesn't mean the centrists are going to go against her after she does it. In fact, she basically kind of said to everybody here, she didn't say quit threatening, but what she said was, to basically keep your powder dry and try to have a little team spirit here. Look, I'll real quick go back to, the days I was in Congress where within the Democrat and Republican parties, you would have factions. But in the end, those factions on the Democratic side or Republican side tended to find some space together, then take your best shot to defend what you did or gripe against it, you know. But these people jumping forward to the speaker to say, well, I'm not going to vote for this if you do that. And then the other side says, well, I'm not going to vote for this if you do that. I think she's smart enough to maneuver that bill through the landmines. Then they'll have to address the rest. And again, it's frankly not a House problem. It's Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema.
Yeah, and I think it's more Sinema than it's Manchin. Because I think Manchin, I think Manchin wants to vote for something. You're not going to get $3.5 trillion, as we've discussed. But something. I think Sinema's, I don't know, man, there's something there.
Well, you know what she's done, too? I don't have any proof of this, but I said this 3 weeks ago. They're laying back. They're letting Manchin be the face of this, hoping, he'll do some deal. When in all reality, I think she's been laying back because she doesn't want to do anything. And I think you're right. I think he will come up with a number. I'm not so sure she wants to.
Which is just crazy.
So we'll see.
We will see.
Be a lot of pressure.
I'm like I said. I hope we get something. I'm still fearful we get nothing.
Right.
And we'll see how that plays out. But Bob, I appreciate the time as always. Great stuff.
Thank you.
Good stuff, our good friend Bob Ney. Look, as I said, I don't know what it is that either of them really want. Is it is it no bill? Is it a $1.5 trillion Build Back Better bill? We got to get something. Something has to happen to move forward, because ultimately that's investment in the country. That's going to help us get back. It's going to help us get back on our feet and moving in the right direction. And finally, this just, I happened to watch, you know, some cable news today, and this was all over the place, and I don't know why, but evidently, Britney Spears is no longer under the conservatorship of her father, which, you know, she's like how old? Evidently she's been under his thumb all this time. He controls the money. They have another person also who was doing some of this. They were in court today with some really just bizarre allegations. The father spying on them. You know, we heard the testimony, you know, a while ago about, you know, how they forced her to get an IUD. They blocked her from getting married. They whole bunch of things. Put her on lithium because she was being difficult during rehearsals for some concert. Just all kinds of insanity. And I'm going, I don't quite know why. I know she had some mental health issues years ago. But, you know, isn't this one of those things where you just kind of go, this woman's worth millions of dollars. I think she can, I don't know, maybe better than most people be able to get out from under the thumb of her father there. Yeah, but here's the part that's really kind of crazy. The video footage of the people outside the courthouse, you would have thought that this was a massive trial with national security implications. There were literally 1,000 people there. And I'm going, you know, are we that into Britney Spears? I mean, is this that big of a deal? Now, I would argue maybe we have some problems with dealing with people with mental illness. Maybe we have some problems because evidently this goes back to 2008. Evidently she was hospitalized for an evaluation. No details that they've put out. But I'm going, that's 13 years of someone basically controlling this woman at every turn. And you know, wow. Crazy. But evidently she's out from under the father. And not sure if the conservator that they had will continue forward. But, you know, we'll see. Now maybe Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz will have another rally that they can go to get a little bit of attention. Because, like I said earlier, they sure were, or Gaetz was sure ridiculous today during the Milley hearing and the Austin and McKenzie hearings. Man, we're so screwed. when the Britney Spears thing got more attention, I'm sometimes at a loss for words at what passes for media. Oh, and the other good thing today, Kamala Harris has a bust of Thurgood Marshall in her office. That was actually a story. That just sad. Just sad. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Make sure you check us out on social media. Follow us on Twitter @RickSmithShow. Like us over at Facebook. Subscribe at YouTube, all of that stuff. Make sure you tune in Saturdays, WBAI New York City. We do our annual call-in show. Thanks for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick. At rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.